In August of 1958, Clifton Keith Hillegass launched a company providing a line of 16 Shakespearean study guides. What was this company's name? Well, naturally, it was Cliff Notes. You know, those little books students around the world use to pass exams and write papers without actually having to read the whole book. Well, sure, Clifton may have launched something successful that helps students kind of get through life without doing a whole lot of extra work. However, Chris Landry comes back for part two of an interview to explain why you can't use Cliff Notes in scouting. And it all comes down to four letters. Because you gotta be willing to put in the work.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you to come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great Scott.
This time as we step off the DeLorean, the year is 1958, and we're in Lincoln, Nebraska. Yes, Lincoln, Nebraska, 1958. What are we doing here? There a game going on? Well, not in Lincoln, Nebraska. Are we watching on television the greatest game ever played? The December 1958 NFL Championship between the New York Giants and the Baltimore Colts? You know, the one that went into overtime, the first time ever in NFL Championship history, going into sudden death overtime? Johnny Unitas? That NFL Championship game. No, we're not watching that. Not 1958 in Lincoln, Nebraska. That's not why we're here. The reason is because we're going to talk about Clifton Keith Hillegass. We're going to talk to him about his new product that he has, something called Cliff Notes, which is an important time in history. A great idea, but also bad for society. It creates a whole bunch of slackers, you know, just like in Back to the Future. Quit being a slacker and that kind of thing. Not willing to put into work, which, if you're not willing to put into work, leads to a bad product and the end result. And it brings us now to the football crossroads, because Chris Landry, the guest on this episode, we talked to him last week, he's going to contend that this is exactly one of the reasons why the great scout is going extinct. Maybe that's not his terms, but that's kind of what he's getting at, because nowadays, a lot of people aren't willing to put in the work, and that's what separates the great scout from just a run-of-the-mill, I'm gathering information and hoping I pick the right kind of dude. You got to put in the work, you got to put in the time. And we're going to get into that more in this upcoming episode. But again, if you have not listened to part one of the Chris Landry Experience, and I recommend highly that you mash this pause button, go back to that episode and listen to how Chris goes on about so many different things of the scouting world. Let's just say there's a 10-minute part just off the cuff. I don't know, maybe it's more than 10 minutes, maybe it's less than 10 minutes, of one of those things like, I asked him, explain to me how you would look at a quarterback. Basically, what would he look like if you're looking at me and I'm trying out to be a quarterback? What I got to say to you is, this was insanely informative. And I can understand that in those 10 minutes, that he definitely has spent a lifetime in football serving as a coach, scout, and administrator for both college and the NFL level. So for a quick recap, he was also selected as a coordinator for the NFL Scouting Combine in 1993, and then unfortunately he had to leave the game because he had to tend to sick family members. But at the time, NFL teams were all like, man, you're way too valuable. So they would continue to reach out to him, contact him for help. And now, that's led into what he does for a living. He runs his own company called Landry Operations, but also he has another entity called LandryFootball.com. There's many different, way too much to talk about here, avenues for you to learn more about the game of football. And I'm going to go ahead and leave some links to both of these sites, his podcasts, and other places that you can get a hold of Chris, and also the first part of the interview on a dedicated page for Chris on my website, which you can get to by heading to thefootballhistorydude.com/Chris Landry. Again, that's thefootballhistorydude.com/Chris Landry. And well, also, while you're at it, I ask that you please subscribe for free to this show by mashing that little subscribe button, your podcast player of choice. That way you get the hottest, freshest off the press episodes, well, each and every week. And again, before we get into it, I want to remind you this is a three-part interview, so you'll definitely want to go ahead and get subscribed because you're going to get that next episode as soon as it releases. But for now, let's get right into the second part of the Chris Landry experience. Chris, that was one of the most impressive and informative 10 minutes I think I've ever listened to a straight audio.
Well, appreciate it. It's real detailed. It's a little bit, you know, I think a lot of what we talk about now in football is summations of what we see. But, you know, a summation, you know, as I always say, you can't scout by cliff notes. You know, those cliff notes that we had in college that we go, I don't want to read the catcher in the rye. I'm going to read the cliff notes. You know, I'm raising my hand. I did that. Well, but you know, you don't know the details and you don't know how you got to it. Somebody had to read that to write the cliff notes. So you can, you know, read what other people think about it, but you've got to go through all the details. And then when you do all of that, then you come to the overall grade of what makes the guy successful. And everything you read about a player is a summation, but the details of the report is very, very, you know, and there's other stuff on the reports, the, you know, the personal background information. Where did he grow up? What's his family background? You know, those things tell you a lot too, you know, about the makeup of a kid and in those situations. It tells you a little bit about, and of course, we do a lot of things psychologically. We have psychologists study different things about a player. I give you a perfect example. We're at the combine. I was with the Oilers, and I wanted to draft Eddie George. Floyd Reese and Jeff Fisher, our head coach, really like Lawrence Phillips. And we were going to take a back, and we liked, you know, a couple of backs, but I liked Eddie George. And when we went to the combine, I spent a lot of time with Lawrence Phillips. I had Jeff Fisher spend a lot of time with him. And I learned a lot about Lawrence Phillips. But one of the things we had them fill out some information, because it really helps you. Because sometimes when people write things, they may not say it, and they may say it and don't write it. So I like to do both. When I looked at basic information that I always wanted them to fill out, mother, his answer, don't know. Father, don't know. Didn't know never knew who his mother or father was. Person you're closest to in your life, my brother. Tell me about your brother, Jerome. How often do you see him? And I haven't seen him for 7 years, coach. He's been incarcerated in the Los Angeles State Penitentiary. So I'm starting to realize, okay, it's starting to, again, no excuses for behavior. There are a lot of people that didn't know their mother and father that didn't beat people and do bad things. But you do know, and we all, I think, can understand that, you know, some people are not strong enough and don't come from the background. So I came from the conclusion that this guy that really didn't have the upbringing. He was, when he was on campus at Nebraska, he got into a certain amount of trouble, but it was controlled to some degree. In Lincoln, Nebraska, you can control things. And Coach Osborne and Coach McBride and those guys, or Coach Solich, say, you know, things were handled and a lot of things didn't get out publicly as much back then. But I knew there was an issue. So I said, we need to have him evaluated professionally. The psychologist came back and said, and there are different things that they do it that are really of nothing to do. They ask questions that I don't even understand. It's above and beyond. It has nothing to do with football, but it has all personal psychological profiles. And I read it and I listened to the report basically said that, you know, as long as he was under close structure, he would be okay. But the minute, the off season, when he didn't have that structure of being at a meeting at a certain time every day, he would always revert back to what he knew best. And what he knew best, The only family he had were drug dealers in gangs in inner city LA. So he was, in the eyes of the professional psychologist, thought that that's where he was always going to be. Well, you know, after that, you know, and if you combine that with the fact that it matched the problems that he had at Nebraska, we were able to, you know, I was able to convince him, look, this is not the direction we need to go. As it turned out, the Rams took him before we would have had a chance, and that was to our benefit. But we wouldn't have taken him. But at some point on film, you look at certain things, he had a lot of ability. But Eddie George kind of fit the mold, and the background and everything, you know, kind of. So there's a lot of things that go into the medical history. All those things are really important. There's a lot of money that goes into it, and therefore there's a lot of detail that goes into making up the process of evaluating these players. But I'm glad you liked it. A lot of people would fall asleep listening to the details, because it is a lot of detail. And imagine sitting in a meeting where you're going over the details of every player. Now, we don't in meetings, if a guy's been deemed a reject, we don't spend as much detail after we go over them initially and we explain why they're not worthy of putting on even the what we call we put them on the reject board, which means we would not even sign him as an undrafted free agent. Then the second round of meetings, we're spending more time on anybody that we would either sign as an undrafted free agent or consider drafting at some point in the draft. But imagine going through basically several weeks of meetings, going, you know, sometimes two full days of, you know, 18-hour days going over every player that is at least on your draft board. At a position, it may take 2 days per position to get through all the players, and going through that much detail and having three or four people go through those details of what I just went through. It's a lot of minutia.
Yeah, I can imagine. And speaking of, I guess the best way to put it is, are there variations or different forms or mentalities of scouting, like different types of coaches out there, or is it pretty much standard?
Oh, there are differences. I mean, you know, again, philosophically, the game has evolved and changed. And as, you know, to me, what you have to do is have an organizational philosophy. And you can't be you can't, for example, if you're going to be working with a coach that likes big corners, it doesn't matter if a guy's small and he's quick. If he doesn't fit what you want to play, well, then, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. If you're a one gap team, you're going to maybe want a three technique, obviously, that can penetrate, get upfield. I mean, Aaron Donald could play for anybody, but he's a one gap player. If you put him as a two gap player, it's like taking a sports car and driving it on the farm and getting it all dent up with rocks. It doesn't make any sense, really. So, you know, you have to understand, oh, we're going to be a two gap front or one gap front. You know, what's our, you know, our philosophy on what we want size wise with our defensive tackles versus quickness, what you're willing to give up, you know, if you've got to decide. So you have to hash through that, which is why, by the way, certain organizations are successful and some are not. Think about the teams that are always picking high. What is the common theme? They're constantly changing coaches, constantly changing philosophy. So you never build towards anything. So it's like building a house, got a good frame and all the framing in, but just in time when you start to lay the sheetrock and you get the wiring done, somebody comes in, rips everything out, and you start over again. That's what they have done in places that are bad for a long time. They're constantly changing philosophies. And I'm not advocating, if you're losing and doing a poor job, just keep them for the sake of keeping them. What I'm saying is you have to have a stringent philosophy. And I think understand that if you're going to spend resources, draft picks, salary cap money to build a certain team, and you're going to be changing philosophies every 2 to 3 years, well, then you're never going to ever build towards anything. And so I think it's important to be on the same page, But everybody absolutely has different philosophies on what they want in one position, which is why I said at the beginning, there's no such thing as, well, this is the best corner, this is that. There are a handful of players in every draft that could line up, play for anybody, and do, and most of them fit under the role of the beauties in the eye of the beholder. You know, it's like, what is the most beautiful? We look at the Miss Universe pageant. I mean, you could probably, if you sit there and watch it, you could probably have 20 of them. You think, well, this is the most beautiful one. Well, no, I think this one's, they're all talented, all beautiful. In this case, you got a lot of talented players, but which one fits what we want to do? And I'm not even talking about needs. Needs come into it too, but I'm talking about in terms of what fits, what's the priority, what's the toughest position to fill in the draft, where is there the most depth? That's why you have draft boards. So you can say, look, we got greater depth that we can get an offensive guard in the fifth round. We're not going to be able to get a tackle in the fifth round. So if all else is equal, we're going to take the tackle a little bit higher than the guard, or, you know, the end a little bit higher than the linebacker, the corner a little bit higher than the safety, you know, the big time receiver a little bit higher than the fungible running back, the quarterback's higher than anybody because they're the most difficult to find. So everybody has their own philosophy, and if philosophies definitely change and evolve, which is why I said you're looking at these critical factors, but you need to rank them in terms of what's most important. And sometimes you need to adjust it a little bit and say, this is more important, or let's take this out and add that. Those things are all pivotal.
So, of course, we have, like you said, the team philosophies and the coach philosophies. How about in the family of the scouts or the scouting brotherhood? What are there varying styles of scouting?
Well, I think what's happened over the years is, and I think what's changing is we're seeing more and more people getting into scouting that really don't have a football background. So they're not real evaluators as much as they are information gatherers. So what's happening now, mostly in scouting, is guys that will go in to a school on a school visit. They get all the background information. They're taught to look for certain things, and they'll put an eyeball grade on a player, and people higher up in the organization are going to ultimately make the call on where the player gets graded. So they're not relying on the scout to really do so much of the evaluation, but the background. Now, there are two things that come into it, in my opinion. And again, when I certainly was with the Oilers and the Titans, we basically ran the draft. There were only four of us as scouts, so we had to go across the entire country. We were the meetings. We set up the draft board. We really drafted the players, and they relied on us. That's becoming less and less of a thing. The other thing that I think hurts with today's scouting is with the younger people is it takes a long time to develop sources within a school. So give you an example. You going into a school, you'll visit with the trainer and the strength coach and different people, and you might have a whole bunch of scouts and the strength coach is talking to them. They'll give generic stuff. Yeah, you know, Orner's comes from this high school and he's got, you know, both parents still alive. He's from Iowa. He's computer science major. He's good. I mean, you know, just basic, got a girlfriend, you know, he's had these injuries. I mean, just basic generic stuff that you get. But if you've been in a school for 25, 30 years, sometimes you have certain people, maybe not the coaches, because the coaches come and go. But there's a trainer that's been there 20 years. There's an academic advisor that's been there for a long time. There's an assistant athletic director that's a head of food services, or an equipment manager, that you've been around a long time. You can go quietly pull them aside and say, hey, tell me about Arnie. Tell me about this guy. If you went into Washington State and asked about Ryan Leaf, Mike Price would tell you nothing but great things. You couldn't get anything. If you went and studied and talked to his high school coach in Montana, You could find out the true story about Ryan Leaf and you could have seen the whole deal. There's a lot of things that you get missed. And that's just like, I would imagine it would be like being a reporter. Well, if you've been around a long time and you have a lot of sources, you can get more information. If you're kind of new, you got to develop those sources, develop that trust. So I think what's happened with a lot of new folks, what they've done is use the younger guys to go out, be the bird dogs of information, and then let the coaches and maybe the upper people in the pro player personnel department maybe get the real skinny on the player because maybe they know, or maybe one of their coaches is good friends with one of the coaches on that staff. They can find out the true story of the player and, you know, maybe get you a little bit more information that you need to know. And so I think what we're seeing now is the quality of scouting from the scouts is not as good because a lot of them come from other avenues that's not from coaching. And I think that hurts their ability to evaluate. And a lot of them just, you know, just gather information. And I think that's what's changed more than anything I've noticed over the years.
Yeah, I've seen that even in the place I work, manufacturing, where you may get somebody that comes in that they have these degrees and they've been taught in a book, but then they don't have any experience with a particular product or even how manufacturing works. So they don't understand how it's going to change and it's going to react in the real world kind of thing.
No, that's right. And it's to me, you know, I always tell people and when I do a lot of coaching search stuff, you know, I say, well, we want somebody that knows this system. And I'm like, no, you don't. What you want is somebody that knows how to evolve a system. Because systems don't win. Schemes don't win. It's the ability to evolve a scheme and learn. And, you know, what's the saying? You can give somebody fish and feed them for a day, or you can teach them how to fish and feed them for a lifetime. Well, the people that know how to see the game, learn the game, evolve with the game, scouting and coaching, those are the ones that are successful because you don't just take one thing and say, boy, this is that. And it's like we just talked about. There's so many things that have evolved and changed in how you do it. You've got to be open. You got to embrace it. And you got to learn from it. And you just take all those little things and like brick by brick, just kind of build yourself a foundation that you can call upon so that you, again, know how to siphon things out and know what's important and know what's the priority. And if you can do those things, the people that can do those things the best are the most successful.
So taking that piece of advice and maybe even expanding upon it, if you could go back in time and tell your, I don't know, 20-year-old self one piece of advice for all the years you've learned, what would you tell them?
Trust your judgment. Scouting, I always say scouting, if you know how to scout and what to look for, a player is going to grade himself. You just got to know what to look for. What I think happens and what I learned early on was I was at a school one time. I can remember it was Mississippi State. And I was a young scout in a school visit. And I'm looking at a player and we're looking at several players. But there's one player in particular. I'm in that with one other scout. And this guy was a legendary scout, just a guy that's been around 30-something years. And I, because of my inexperience, he was a guy that talked about, man, look at this. Man, I like this. I like this guy doing this. You tend to scout with your ears. You tend to see something that's not there. And what I learned early on is, and I never forget it, I had the wrong grade on the guy because I started to question what I was seeing and I started seeing things that I was hearing. And you got to be careful with that. And so what I learned is do your work. If you're thorough, the player's going to start to come to you and trust your judgment. And don't worry about if other people like them or don't like them because, you know, you can really. You get caught in making mistakes by listening to things. Now, I think there's some things that are valuable. If you're a scout and you go into a school in September and it's early November and you got a buddy that maybe you were in the, you were at Illinois together, you know, and he may say, hey, you know, that linebacker we looked at, boy, he's healthy and playing a lot better. Oh, really? He is. Then I made me make a physical or mental note to go back and look more at that guy because maybe he changed. Not, you know, well, guy says he's good, I'm going to raise his grade. No, I'm just going to go do more work. It's intel is always good. You have two ears, one mouth, use them accordingly. So always never talked a whole lot and listened a lot. And what I did is tried to trust my eyes more than my ears in terms of don't get talked into or out of a player because maybe the conventional wisdom is a certain things. I think that's the most important thing I learned. And I think if you trust that, you'll be more successful than not.
So would it be fair to say, know the process and follow the process?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that if you do that, it's maybe your position as a scout to not, set the criteria, but to follow it. And yes, if you adhere to that and do your job, that is going to often lead you in the right direction.
So speaking of leading you in the right direction and following a process as a scout, we're coming up on the NFL scouting combine here. And you've mentioned you've been involved in every one since the beginning, right?
Correct. We had one in Phoenix, one in Tampa, one in New Orleans, and then we went to Indianapolis, and we've been in Indianapolis ever since.
And then you said that you were the coordinator for one of them in your on your website. What would that really entail?
Everything. I did that for a couple of years, and what I did, everything. I mean, I basically the way I like to describe it is I was everybody's assistant. You coordinate everything from picking the players, which you had a committee, and we picked the players that we were going to invite. Organized with a certain person that handle our travel, they got in touch with every player, and you had to make sure that you oversaw travel. So, you know, we had a travel agency that we cut a contract with that they were responsible as a travel agency to get in touch with every player, whether it was a rental car and they were, you know, at Purdue and driving, or whether they were flying in from Wyoming, you know, getting all that done, working with the hotels to get hotels blocked, working with the Methodist Hospital on having everything that we needed for x-rays. We have a special interest into the hospital. And then we had working with the people at the convention center at the, it used to be the Hoosier Dome and RCA Dome. Now it's Lucas Oil Stadium. The convention center has all the medicals and everything in there. You've got to work with a number of people to get all the equipment in and set up, working with every team trainers in the NFL. Had a committee of team trainers that helped me organize all the other trainers underneath, make sure that every station was covered, all the team doctors, which doctors can be a pain to deal with. But, you know, you make sure that they all were at their response. All the food we're going to eat and all the meetings we're going to have. The combine is not only just there for that, but it's also what we call convention week. It's where we have our player personnel director meetings. The general managers have their meetings. The trainers have their meetings. The video directors have their meetings. The agents have their meetings. You got it. You everything, you know, and so coordinating all that through everything from hotels to travel to the workouts, what drills we're going to run, what coaches are going to run the drills, what players are into each groups, how that's going to play out. You have what we call group leaders or scout leaders, where every group is led by two different scouts, one in front of the line, one in the back of the line, that are taking them from station to station to make sure that they're where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there. Making sure that there's soft drinks in the meeting rooms to, you know, you name it. It was involved in everything from stem to stern. We'll have more x-rays and more MRIs done in one weekend at that hospital than they'll have the entire year combined.
Yeah, that sounds like an insane
event to have to try to coordinate and get everything done in such a short amount of time for me.
Yeah, no, it is. Well, and it's, look, it was an all year process to really work it. I mean, you, and then you obviously have the detailed information, all the results needed to be typed in by the secretarial group that puts it in. It's distributed. We literally at that time, it's all sent on a disc. But back then we used to still send it in on a disc. Now it's uploaded to where they can get it. But we used to make hard copies and literally FedEx it from the hotel to the team's facility. So when they left the combine, when they got back in, the FedEx was there that very day with all the results and all the information that through the whole week, you know, the weekend that was there. So it's a very involved process. It's changed over the years. When I was doing it, the media wasn't allowed. It was strictly players were there to interview with teams, to get their medical physicals, to do their workouts, take intelligence and psychological testing, and then go home. Now it's become, it's changed ever since the NFL Network, television network came into fold, and that they're actually going to be doing the workouts at night now for TV audiences. And they have a lot of media interviews and all that, which is fine, but it takes away time from what I think's most important. It's become more of a media event. But what I would say is the things that they show the most on TV are the things that are the least important of what football people get out of it. The combine was started for one reason. One reason only. It was for medical physicals. When we started it, it was just that. And the reason is, prior to that, players were just running around and going to 15, 16 cities and bringing their x-rays with them on planes to one site, to the Eagles and to the Falcons and the Cowboys. It's ridiculous. So we need to bring them all in one location, get all the medical stuff, and then share it with everybody. And now every medical doctor can interpret it the way he wants. But instead of having these kids fly crisscross across the country, we'll get them all in one place. So we actually had kind of a quad combines where you have like five or six teams would get together and coordinate, and another five or six to do it this location. And then when we first started it, we said, no, we're going to have it in one location. Well, once we got them there, we said, well, let's time them. We're certainly going to measure and weigh them. And we're going to do some measurements. We'll do a broad jump, vertical jump, more time them. And then, you know, that was it. We didn't do drills and all that first. Then we said, you know, we got them here. Let's do this drill and then that drill. And then now it's become, you know, where we do a whole bunch of stuff that's where it's kind of evolved over time and changed.
Yeah. And another thing that's evolved just in general, you mentioned this earlier about Blesto. I had no idea that there were multiple scouting arms in the league. I just, as a general fan, always assumed each team just had their own scouts and that was it.
Well, each team does have their own scouts. What Blesto and National, the two scouting organizations, do is this. Each team that's a member of Blesto and each team that's a member of National actually pays the scout salary, but assigns them to National or Blesto. So let me explain it this way. So the Steelers, they belong to Blesto, an original member of Blesto. So they will hire a scout, and he'll be what's called the Blesto scout. And that means that he may have a certain part of the country that he covers. He goes and covers those schools. His reports not only go to the Steelers, but to all the other teams. And then, you know, of course, there are other scouts with the Steelers that just are just working for the Steelers. And the way these two scouting organizations work is the country's broken down to like 12 to 15 regions. So if you've got the Northeast, if you've got the West Coast, you've got the Southwest, the Southeast, whatever, you'll have about 40 schools. Your job is to go to every one of those schools that play football, whether they've had a player every year, whether if you're scouting the state of Texas and, you know, you go to Texas every year, but you may not go to Sam Houston State, but once every 5 years, because they may not have a player. Well, the combine scout goes to every school, regardless how small, every year, and they get the list of all the senior players, upcoming seniors. They get a verified height, weight, and speed on them, and they will quote-unquote put guys on the list if they're deserving, meaning they're worthy of looking at. And then you know, that's how it's done. That's your starter list. And in May, there are two meetings. There are spring meetings that we have where broken down by school that, okay, here's all the schools where there are players, and that's your starting point to start fall scouting. And actually in the summer, you start looking at film, and you start maybe going into schools when there are two-a-day practices, not too much two-a-day practices anymore in college. But you go to schools and you start looking at those guys. So, yeah, you might go to – you're going to go to USC every year. You're going to go to Cal every year. But you might not go to Azusa Pacific, but once every 10 years. But the combine scout's going to be there every year to make sure that there's not a player you need to look at. If there's nobody there, well, then – and nobody props up. And now this day and age, you got to be careful with all the transfer portal, because you might not have anybody at Azusa Pacific in May. But in August – somebody might have transferred from Stanford, and you got to know about. And so it's the job to make sure that here's what's going on. And so the teams are aware of, hey, there's a guy that's popped up. He's at the school. So the area scout in the West Coast will stop by Azusa Pacific and make sure and put a grade on him. So the scouting organizations are the ones that kind of get the background information, get the basics, and kind of help you kind of fetter out where you need to go. Because, you know, in the case of like myself, as I mentioned, we were with the Oilers. Well, I didn't have time to just go to a place unless they really had a player to look at. And if a guy propped up, the first thing I would do would be, you know, if a guy propped up at Delaware, or a guy propped up at Azusa Pacific, or a guy propped up at, you know, at Iowa Wesleyan or Northern, whatever, I'd look at the tape, and if he warranted, then I'd make a call. I'd get background information. And then maybe when I was going in the spring, and let's just say it was Iowa Wesleyan. Well, if I'm going to Iowa State for a pro day, I stop by Iowa Wesleyan and do work in the spring to do what we call a full workup on the guy. So you can backtrack on that. But if you have a larger staff, you can cover more of it. If you got a smaller staff, you really rely on, hey, having a housing group that can keep you up to date on where guys are moving and coming from. Now, again, it's a lot more complex, because back in the day, you didn't have very few transfers. Now transfers are the norm, and it's very easy for them to transfer and be eligible in some cases right away, all the graduate transfers. So you never know. You might have a kid that's, you know, from Boston College, it goes to Miami, or Miami that goes to California, and you know, all of a sudden you got completely different players. So communicating all that's really vitally important.
Yeah, it sounds like a big inner web of different kinds of dances there. And earlier you mentioned how when you're scouting a player, you're basically grading them against the standard. How hard is it to grade against the standard when it's a small school versus a big school?
Dang, there's just so much that goes into scouting, way more than I even imagined. And we didn't even get to the top of it, the bottom of it. I don't know which way we're going. All I know is that he has so much information to share with us. That's why we turned this into a three-part interview. And of course, you know I had to leave you with the cliffhanger. I mean, no pun intended with the whole Cliff Notes thing and stuff, because Chris Landry has been dropping gridiron knowledge nuggets about scouting all over the place. And I really do hope that you enjoyed this second part of the Chris Landy experience, because we continue to gain just so much information from this individual that I don't think my brain can entirely wrap around and grasp how much goes into scouting. Maybe you can, I don't know, but I just, it's super cool to see how there's just so much that goes into preparation of picking players for drafts and for teams and such. And of course, then it leads into the potential busts or the gems and the diamonds in the roughs and things like that. But we're going to get him next week again. And if you want to learn more about Chris and what he does, go ahead over to the dedicated page on his website. Well, my website for him, that is. You can get to that by heading to thefootballhistorydude.com. /Chris Landry. Also, if you enjoy the show, please share it with some of your football geeks such as yourself, because we want them also to learn about this crazy amount of information on how the scouting game works. And next week, we're going to go ahead and dive right back into this interview and finish it off with part 3 of the Chris Landry Experience. But for now, dudes, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.